Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. We live in a time of intense debate about the advances of science and the values of scientists. For this reason alone, the life of the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Max Born is instructive. The story of his life and times offers more than a record of scientific achievement, for he was swept up in the tense drama and stark horror of a nation that abandoned the standards of civilization for the perverse delights of persecution and massacre. Yet through all this, Born evolved an ethics of personal and professional behavior that may stand as his grandest accomplishment and most lasting gift. My guest is Nancy Thorndike Greenspan, author of The End of the Certain World, The Life and Times of Max Born. Nancy, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's very appropriate that we speak of the life of this Nobel Prize-winning physicist in this, the International Year of Physics.
Yes.
Celebrating Einstein's great discovery of 1905. And that is certainly physics and his Max Born's contributions is the overwhelming theme of the book. But there are lots of overwhelming themes of this book. And another one which I want to mention right at the outset is the underlying current of the fate of the Jewish people. Max Born was born Jewish in Germany in the late 19th century, 1883, I believe.
82.
Yes. And the interesting thing to me, Nancy, was the Germany into which he was born and the facts of his life, the affluence and the assuredness of his family, reflected, as I saw it, a kind of community that was very comfortable with being German. I felt that the tastes and traditions of Germany were very important to Max Born and his family at that time. They had been patriots, they had supported the country, and in other words, there was a sense of being a part of a country that would ultimately become, you know, just completely, would try to annihilate them.
Yes. His family worked very hard to be assimilated. They chose to be assimilated. Mm-hmm. They had one side of his family had a great deal of wealth, so they could, in some sense, afford to be assimilated as well. They could contribute to the opera and to the symphony. They could entertain in a grand fashion. They could make themselves acceptable. German Jews had won a full citizenship in 1870, so this was only 12 years before Born was born. Mm-hmm. But his family had been able to get out of the ghetto and out of the rural areas much earlier than 1870. So his father was a physician. Mm-hmm. His grandfather was a physician,
right,
which is unusual. And that was on actually the side of the family that wasn't that wealthy. And on the other side, the family was in textiles. Mm-hmm. And they felt very comfortable in that world when Max Born's father married for a second time because his mother had died, mm-hmm, a woman who had an accent that was more Eastern European Jewish, mm-hmm, the assimilated Jews in the family weren't very comfortable with her.
Yeah.
So there was this, they were comfortable in the world they created, but they knew that there was another world out there,
right,
in that sense.
Well, the book is very honest about that and very honest about what we, I guess we might call the kind of class tensions among German Jewry at that time.
Yes.
And later. You mentioned his father, and I think that bears even more mention because he lost his natural mother very early. I think he was 4 years old,
yes,
when she died.
Yes.
But his father, it seems to me, was an extraordinary influence on his life, even after his father's death. I mean, the memory of him persisted.
Absolutely, and it actually gets his father and his father's ideals became Max Born's, and that very much gets to the issue of the ethics and science. His father was a highly ethical person. He actually had a boss in this. He was an embryologist in this lab that he worked in who was very anti-Semitic and treated him terribly. But when his father had a chance to move to a different place, he could only move if he renounced his religion, and he said it was good enough for my father. I won't do that, even though he didn't practice religion.
Mm-hmm.
He had a very strong sense of morality and what he was, and he passed that on to his son, who lost his father. Max lost his father when Max was 18.
Mm-hmm.
So He was one of these wonderful people. His father was one of these wonderful people who loved nature and introduced his father to nature. It was the biology that Max was introduced to by his father was a little bit too memory-oriented and not enough abstract for him. Right. So he didn't pick up on that side of it, but he appreciated that all of his life and the sense of purpose in life that his father gave him, and that you could compromise, but you made trade-offs, and some of those trade-offs weren't worth it, and that was important.
I think this bears enormous emphasis. I mean, we're talking about a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, and of course, that is the way the world does honor him. But it's also quite striking that he took these values from his father at this very early age. I'm thinking particularly of his kind of skeptical religious independence, if I can phrase it that way. And this seems to me to be a theme throughout his life. But it wasn't just a rejection of religion per se, but perhaps of orthodoxy and formalism, but it was an acceptance of the need for moral responsibility.
Yes. I mean, he saw himself really as a humanist. He told his wife at various times, who was religious in a traditional sense, that her religion wasn't for him. He honored his God in his own way, and he didn't want to be pushed around by her to go to church or whatever, and he didn't do it for the most part. But he did have a sense of a oneness. His idea of religion was a community of like-minded thinkers who honored peace in the world, who honored people. It was very much in the humanistic tradition. But by the same token, when he got kicked out of Germany in 1933, he identified very strongly with the Jewish people, even though by then he had converted himself, and felt, I am a Jew. Whatever happens to the Jews, it will happen to me. I accept that, and that's who I am. And he never tried to run away from that piece of his background.
Absolutely. Max Born never turned his back on the Jewish people, much to the contrary.
Right.
I'm glad we established this at the outset, because I think that his humanism really is deserves equal standing, if you will, with his science. Now let's talk about the science. And when he arrives at the University of Göttingen.
Got it. It's all right.
How does he become a physicist? How does he discover physics as his expression, as the kind of thing he's going to do professionally? What magic occurs there? I mean, I was struck by, for example, him being the scribe of Professor Hilbert and sort of getting introduced to the scientific community at Göttingen at a very high level. But it seems to me there's an attraction to the entire life of the scientist that happens to him there, a kind of magic.
Yes, but just to step back for people who struggle when they're in elementary school, I just want to say that he was a very mediocre student and particularly didn't like school when he was a kid.
Right.
He didn't like to memorize. He didn't want to learn the times tables. I don't think he ever did very well, actually.
Right.
But by the time he was 20-ish, he went to the University of Göttingen to study math, which is interesting for someone who can't do times tables. And he got swept up in the world of beauty is what it ended up being.
Yeah.
Math is very beautiful. To those who appreciate its symmetry, its symbolism, what it says with its symbols. And he spent the rest of his life trying to discover truth, because in the truth he saw a beauty. And at first he tried to do that through mathematics. The abstraction was what attracted him. The concrete part of it did not. But when he was able to think his abstract thoughts about mathematics, he became pulled in. He discovered early on with Hilbert that he couldn't get quite abstract enough, that pure mathematics, when he was given a specific task that was going to be his dissertation topic by Hilbert, he couldn't do it. And he actually was quite upset. He had to turn to something else. At the University of Göttingen, the tradition was not only in pure mathematics, but in applied mathematics. And so he was able to take the math that he had, and he happened to be a very good mathematician. He wasn't at the caliber of David Hilbert, who was one of the best of the century, but he was a wonderful mathematician, and saw that with this tool, which he saw was his real contribution, in a sense, to science, he could be creative and he could think in a physics sense, whereas Einstein or Niels Bohr were more in an intuitive sense. Einstein could see himself on a light beam. Bohr didn't think in those terms. He thought in the terms of in the symbols of mathematics. And so he took that math and applied it to the physical world to uncover the truths of the physical world. And that's what his goal in life was.
At the end of the First World War, Germany was given a peace that many Germans felt was too punitive, etc. And then the pressures began to build, which would eventually lead to Hitler, which is obviously an enormous part of our story. The Germany that he knew was beginning to unravel just as his career, I think, was beginning to start. I mean, the whole...
Yes.
And I want to get a sense from you of how those pressures were mounting on him, on the scientific community, and particularly on the Jewish scientists at that period. I mean, there's an extraordinary collision here.
Yes.
Of creativity and this sort of looming cloud of repression.
Yes. Well, he was a, I guess would be called an associate professor in our terms, mm-hmm. At the start of World War I. He had just received his first appointment in Germany. It's a little bit different than we do it. But he ended up having to go into the army, but he did research. He became close friends with Einstein in Berlin and was persuaded partly through his father's teachings to him when he was young and an emphasis of that by Einstein during the wartime that of a more pacifistic nature. Mm-hmm. And he wanted, it turned out he wanted, along with Einstein, hoped that Germany would lose so that a new Germany could arise. And they were both very excited when all of this happened. There was a Social Democrats became in charge of the government. Mm-hmm. And then there was this peace treaty, the Versailles Treaty, that really decimated Germany. And one of the problems was that the armistice was in November 11th, 1918. The British kept the blockade on Germany until July of 1919.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And people starved. Mm-hmm. They couldn't get food. It was just as bad mm-hmm. as during the war. It was a horrible, horrible time. And Born saw this and saw that what was hoped for the people to come together, they were actually becoming more polarized by extremists, because you had the communists there, you had the people who wanted to go back to the empire, you had people in the middle who just wanted to survive. I mean, this is really about survival.
Right.
And it allowed right then a tremendous amount of hostility towards other people in the world. Other people in the world were still hostile towards the Germans. And it took, and Born's career at that point was just beginning, and it was all involved in those particular kinds of pressures that were in Germany and the world. Mm-hmm. German physicists could not write to Allied physicists because the Allied physicists, because of other things that had happened during the war, some letters that had been written, were furious with them. They didn't want anything to do with them. They didn't want to shake, the Allied physicists did not want to shake the hands of German physicists.
Yeah.
There was a tremendous amount of pressure on the German physicists just to try to get their research done. In 1922, Born ended up back in Göttingen, actually for the third time in his career. And at that time, quantum physics was just, well, 12 years before Niels Bohr had started it on a certain mm-hmm. course. And in 1922, Niels Bohr came to Göttingen and gave a talk, and Born decided it was time for him to really focus his attention on quantum theory. Mm-hmm. And that same year, a young assistant came to him by the name of Werner Heisenberg. And they worked together for the next 3.5 years. And although a lot of people confuse Max Born with Niels Bohr, and they mm-hmm. assume that Werner Heisenberg did a lot of his work mm-hmm. with Niels Bohr, his initial contributions, the two of them worked together to do quantum theory, and Heisenberg's initial contribution was when he was working with Born. That whole piece of history for the 20s, whether it would be physics, science, art, music, literature, there was a tremendous creative burst. Mm-hmm. I think, and partly I see it in Germany, historians of that period